For nothing is fixed. Forever and forever it is not fixed. The earth is always shifting. The light is always changing. The sea does not cease to grind down rock. Generations do not cease to be born. And we are responsible to them because we are the only witnesses they have. The sea rises, the light fails. Lovers cling to each other and children cling to us. The moment we cease to hold each other, the moment we break faith with one another, the sea engulfs us and the light goes out. James A. Baldwin. Welcome to the Lost Traveler Podcast. I am your ever-loving host, Henry Cameron Allen. And I'm making a new friend today. Very, very excited to welcome Nathaniel Turner as my co-host for this episode. He is a humanity propulsion engineer, which I really want to get into what that means. He's an author, he's a lawyer, an accountant. And you and I, one of the things that resonated with me when I was reading your bio and watching some of your YouTube videos, your amazing TED Talk, was that you have, well, you're kind of self-described as a Renaissance person and a breath of fresh air. That's how I've been described for most of my life. And so I felt, oh, here's my brother. Here's my friend. So welcome, Nate. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. And now we are now officially BFAM, as I say, brothers from another mother.
Yes. Exactly. And I expect that's just going to deepen and get richer as we go on. One thing that I've started doing, and I'm in my season 4 of the Lost Track podcast with listeners in 41 countries currently. So our focus is really on the universality of the human condition and universal life skills as we all experience them. Every single one of us, 8 billion people on the planet now, are learning the exact same skills. So it's not a question of whether we're learning them, it's how well are we learning them and from whom are we learning them. And what I've taken to doing is asking each of my co-hosts in every episode this season to think about, for the end of the episode, think about a question that you would like to ask to the next co-host coming after you.
Got it.
And I can share with you now, which I think is a great icebreaker and a way for us, for me and the audience to get to know you, is the question that my last co-host left for you.
Okay.
Right. And that question is, what is the vision that you have for the world that you're creating?
What's the vision I have for the world that I am creating?
Yes.
So I am working on a world where everyone will have an opportunity to experience their best life, which is, I describe it as the life they've always imagined. And I imagine that we would give special consideration to what the Bible calls the least of these, but I have termed it the least of us, because I don't want to separate myself from those who have the least, because we're all in, as Mufasa said, we're all part of the great circle of life. So if I am truly a part of the circle, then I cannot be someone outside looking in at the these. I have to be inside the circle with those that are us.
Beautifully said. I love that. Tell me a little bit about your journey, about how you got from birth onto this tiny rock out in the middle of everything to this moment of enlightenment in your life at your age.
I mean, my life is a little bit common and maybe a little bit unusual. I am the product of Tommy and Gladys Turner, and both of my parents were high school educated, and that's the extent of their formal education. Mm-hmm. My father made the decision that he wanted to name his child after Nat Turner, who, if you know the history of Nat Turner, revolutionary, right, et cetera. My mother wanted to name her child as a gift of God. So they both came to this agreement that my name would be Nathaniel. My father would get his wish that I would be named after Nat Turner. My initials are N-A-T. Mm-hmm. And Nat's original or his full name is Nathaniel. And my mother would get her gift of God, which, and she would name me the Hebrew Nathaniel. Mm-hmm. So that in some ways is exactly who my parents have asked me to be, and what I've understood that my mission or my objective or my goal or the destination that I'm supposed to be trying to achieve each day, that when people meet me, I'm supposed to give this feeling that I am a gift from the Creator, mm-hmm. and that I'm also supposed to be someone who is unrelenting and ceaseless about making sure that people are free and have an opportunity to live their best life.
You know, I mentioned to you earlier that we have listeners in 41 countries and growing, and I'm sure that many of our listeners have never heard of Nat Turner. Can you condense the story into a Reader's Digest version?
Sure. The short story is Nat Turner was a slave. He was also a mystic and a minister in Virginia. And for a very long time, he was one of the few slaves that was taught to read and was asked to help essentially keep the other slaves in check by sharing with them the word from the Bible. But what happened one day is Nat was reading the word and realized that he should be free, and that this book that he was reading was about his own liberation, and decided that he was going to do whatever he needed to do to be free. And so he started a revolt, and there was a lot of murder that happened, and at the end he was caught, and he was hung. But that's essentially the story of the Turner. Guy who was a slave decided he no longer wanted to be a slave and wanted to free everybody who was a slave, and so started the revolt.
And I think anybody in the world can relate to that story. We have all been enslaved in one way or another. And, correct. You know, the statistically, when you take into account debt and human trafficking globally, there are more enslaved people on earth today than there ever have been combined in human history. And it behooves us to study the history of enslavement so that we can understand who we are, all of us.
I agree. I mean, we're also intellectually slaves. So we're not talking about the physical sense. We're intellectually slaves. We are enslaved. We are asked to read only certain things. We're asked to listen to only certain things. It's made even more difficult to, in some places, like in the US now, we're moving to a place where only certain books can be read in school. And I'm like, okay, that's fine, but we can read them independently. But I do understand some of the arguments about that. We are enslaved morally, but we're put in a position where we don't really have a whole lot of options. And I'll give an example. So during the day, I work in the financial services. And if a client calls me and says, hey, what should I buy? Mm-hmm. Well, I tell people, whatever you buy, understand there's a hardship this caused on the other end. And people are like, well, what are you talking about? And so whatever you invest in, there is somebody who is injured by what you do. So I said, here's an example. You and I go into a grocery store. Let's say we're going to Target or Walmart somewhere. And if it's 5 o'clock and you're in a hurry, and you have to get home, and your kids have someplace to be at 6 o'clock, you got to get a meal prepared, et cetera, and you run in the store to pick up a few items, what you will find inevitably, there may be two or three cashiers, and there may be two or three people bagging groceries, and then you'll find this whole litany of things called self-checkout lines.
Yeah.
And then the question will be, which one will you choose? Mm-hmm. And then the majority of people say, I'm going through the self-checkout. And I say, well, then don't tell me you care about people. Because right. The algorithm that's being used is determining right now how many bags of groceries, how long you'll stay. And they're figuring out all the data so that they can eliminate the next person. And so yeah, as a shareholder, your stock value is going up because the thing that keeps the share prices down oftentimes is having employees. So the more people I can get rid of, yeah, your share price goes up. And your 401k will improve, and your personal net worth will improve, but your social network will decline. will decrease significantly, and your community will decrease in it, because now pretty soon there'll be fewer people working. So that's what I mean by the sort of enslavement that we're not even aware of that happens to us, right? Spiritually, intellectually, because we're not even thinking about it.
And that's nothing new in human history. I mean, no. You look at you know, global history, and yeah, we're still seeing it everywhere. Now we have the distraction of technology, right? That makes, you know, we love shiny things. We love bells and whistles and ease. You know, I think that humanity has spent millennia trying to make things easy for ourselves. But that comes back to the question of at what expense and at whose expense. Shadow and Light LLC was established by Dave Roberts and Reverend Patty Farino, co-authors of When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister. Their mission is to empower individuals to transcend life challenges by integrating spiritual practices with psychology to achieve peace. They are available for individualized spiritual counseling, virtual or in-person presentations and workshops to universities, organizations, and other interested groups, virtual or in-person book club meetings. For further information, go to psychologyprofessorandminister.com. You've got kids?
I have a son. Yep. Yes. Only one that I know of. So when you say kids, you make me a little nervous.
Listen, let me tell you my perspective on parenting. We are, I'm 57. And
as am I.
Okay. My brother.
I told you.
we are in the parenting generation. In fact, anybody who's of the age that they are physically capable of having children up are of the parenting generation, and there are young eyes upon us. And when we become aware that young eyes are upon us for how to be in the world, the way we enter a room changes, the way we use language, the tone of voice, the way we carry ourselves, the way we meet one another in front of young people, the respect that we pay to other people, right? The politeness and the kindness that we exhibit, those things are absorbed, whether or not we know it. And I think that's a really important message. I'm also a father, a single father of an only child who is no longer on the planet, sadly. He passed from brain cancer when he was 13.
Sorry to hear that.
And thank you. And talk about an existential crisis, you know, when your whole identity is wrapped up in being a parent, and that is plucked out of the equation through the fault of no one, and with no answers as to why an 11-year-old child would have developed a kind of brain cancer that's only found in men over 45. What? There are no answers other than Cameron's answer, my son, who said, "Papa, we're all going to go. Nobody knows when, nobody knows how, but everyone's going to have their time and everyone's going to have their way. And there's nothing you can do about it, whether it's an accident or it's a disease or whether it's by their own hand, God forbid. That's their time and that's their way. And we're here left to figure out what to do with that." Right. And so my journey, which has led me to this moment, and I say this a lot to my co-hosts, that your entire biography, my entire biography, and the biographies of our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, all the way back to our common ancestor, have led us to this moment and this conversation. And that's a whole lot of love. And where we take it from here, and anyone who's listening, I think a lot of good can come out of it. That's why we're doing this, you know?
Yeah. Wow, man, you, like, as a father, like, I don't even know what to say. I again, I said, like, my condolences. I mean, I there are questions that I have. Like, I don't know if that's insensitive to ask you these questions.
No, that's why I'm talking about it, because
how old would Cameron have been if Cameron was here with us today? Well, he is here with us.
He still lives in Dubuque. He would be 28 now had he stayed.
So when is his birthday?
April 16th.
So
yeah.
So April 16th is my sister's birthday.
Okay.
And my son will be 28 this year as well. And you're 57. So there's that. And so as you were telling the story, I just could not imagine. I just 2 weeks ago, my son received his PhD in electrical and computer engineering.
Yeah. Congratulations.
So, yeah, I appreciate it. And I just can't imagine. I cannot imagine what life must be like for you. Like, so what you're doing is incredible, and you're keeping Cameron alive. And I'm going to hold on to that and find a way to also share Cameron and keep Cameron alive.
Thank you.
But I know, like, that's got to be tough, because I know how much that's my son, how much he means to me. And
I can't imagine after 14 years. I'm a veteran now. You know, I mean, it's been a minute. And what I've come to realize is that, and again, everyone, it's kind of like birth. There are common denominators, but every birth is unique. Every gestation is unique. Every relationship that birthed that child is unique, right?
Right.
And it's the same with death. And I don't even believe in death anymore. I think it's an illusion. Hmm. And we can delve into these deep topics, because I love talking about this. It allows me to honor his life.
Right, right, absolutely.
And I added his name to mine. I think you'll like this story. After he passed, a few weeks went by, and I couldn't go to the grocery store without somebody falling apart in my arms. We were beloved in our community. He was beloved in his, you know, group of friends and extended family, adopted mm-hmm. family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really have time to handle my own mourning period, because I was holding up everyone else. And this is after 2 years of being a superhero, holding him up, you know, trying to save him. And I needed to get out of Dodge. I needed to get my scale back. I had been a superhero for 2 years, and I needed to feel my smallness again. And I don't know if you've ever been to the Grand Canyon.
I have, and I got a great story. You guys,
okay.
You're like, there's so many parallels.
So many parallels. You'd never know. And, you know, there are these long stretches of road through the desert before you even get to the canyon, like 70 miles, no gas, right? And I was driving, it was 3 a.m, and I needed to stop. I needed to get a cup of coffee, keep going, whatever. And all I could see was the road in front of me with the headlights on and the sky full of stars. Everything else was this inky, inky black, except there was this bright light on the horizon. And I couldn't tell if it was a star, a planet, or a gas station, the distance. And so I finally made it there. And there was a 100-foot-tall lamppost with one beam of light below it. And there were three buildings, three structures in the beam of this light. One was a small motel. One was a native trading post. And the other one was a post office. This little island of, you know, three buildings in the middle of nowhere had its own zip code. And I looked up at the post office, and it was Cameron, Arizona. I know. It was like Twilight Zone moment, right? So I slept a few hours in the motel. I got up, and there was this elderly, I think she was Zuni tribe woman, sitting on her blanket selling jewelry that she had made. I bought a ring from her, and I said, can I sit with you for a moment? I have a feeling you have some wisdom, and I'm needing some right now. Hmm. She invited me to sit down, and I said, you know, I just lost my son recently, my only child, and I'm sort of at a loss for finding out who I am now. There's no word in any language that we know of, and I've looked, that like widow or orphan to identify a parent of child loss.
Yeah, okay.
There's nothing. And I said, is there anything in your language or culture that holds that? So I can have a sense of who I am and be able to say when somebody asks me, oh, do you have any kids? I don't have to go through the whole, you know, experience of memory. And it was really fresh at the time. I love doing it now. I don't mind. But at the time I was in mourning.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So she said, well, perhaps it's too profound a loss for a mere word to describe. She said, in my culture, your name would change because your name is the expression of your identity. And when the core of your identity is no longer there, you must change your name.
Hmm.
So I might call you Henry, whose son is gone. That becomes your name. It tells the story, enough of it, right? And mm-hmm. anyone who meets you or anyone who thinks about you,
is that Henry?
They're thinking of you as Henry, whose son is gone. So they're holding you in your time of mourning and grief, right? And forever. So I thought, oh, what a beautiful gesture. It doesn't quite fit into the global lexicon. I didn't want to go around calling myself, I am Henry, whose son is gone. Nice to meet you. Welcome to my podcast. But what occurred to me was that already, just a few months after his passing, nobody was speaking his name because they were afraid of bringing stuff up in me, but they were also dealing with their own grief around his loss. And this is a very common factor with parents of child loss, is that not even family will speak your child's name anymore. So I did not find that acceptable. So I hyphenated his name with mine so that it's a bond that will exist forever. And anyone who meets me meets him at the same time. And it's also a mathematical equation that tells a story. It's Henry minus Cameron in the physical sense, not in the spiritual sense, but in the physical sense.
Yeah, no.
It's enough, you know, and it opens up to a whole other way of thinking. Balance, pain mitigation, range of motion, athletic performance, focus, memory, immune system support, and REM level of sleep, all this and more made possible affordably with no pharmaceuticals, no injections, or invasive treatments. Just socks, insoles, and patches made stronger with the tactile patterning of Vox Life products. Scientifically proven to work and guaranteed. Now in the USA, Canada, and the UK. Visit www.dianedinkmeyer.voxlife.com. That's Vox, V-O-X-X, Life. You'll be glad you did. But where have been the pivotal moments in your life that have been just sort of a mind blow, a paradigm shift in your way of thinking and perceiving the world, both as a man, as a person, as a parent?
Lots of incidents. So I'll start with one that I've told a number of times. As a 9-year-old, my parents were finally able to buy a home. I'm not sure that they could have afforded a home, but they bought a home. So that's a whole nother story.
Right.
So we moved to this new community, and I'm originally from Gary, Indiana. So Gary, at the time I was there, was the most segregated city in America. It was 97% Black, first city in America, a large city in America at the time with a Black mayor. I'm just laying sort of the groundwork for what it was like to be in this city. So I lived primarily on the east side of town, and my parents then were able to move west. And there's an area called Miller, and there's the dunes, and there's water. As you can imagine, there were more white people who remained in Gary. They lived mostly in that area. So the area was segregated and was starting to to become integrated. So this is in the mid-70s. And so this was removed, and my parents dropped me off, and I'm in Gary, and now in school with kids who don't look like me for the very first time. So I've got kids who have wealth and privilege in ways that I'm not familiar with. So on my 9th birthday, my parents decide they're gonna buy me a bike for my birthday. And my father says, you know, what do you want? And I wanted a dirt bike, because all the kids in the neighborhood were riding these huffy kind of bikes with the shocks and everything. And I wanted this fake motorcycle bike to ride around. He says to me, don't buy that. He said, I'll get you whatever you want, but that's not what I would encourage you to get. I would tell you to get the 10 speed. I say, Dad, but everybody's riding the motor. I said, I'm telling you, get a 10 speed. Sure enough, right, the next year I turned 10 and nobody's riding motocross bikes anymore. Now, my family doesn't have the money to go buy a 10 speed for me. They bought a bike for me previous year. My father says, first of all, I told you not to get this bike. I told you we're going to outgrow it. It's too small. I tried to tell you last year. Didn't want to listen to me. And now you want me to give you, I think, because I wanted a red Schwinn 10 speed. It was about $125, $150. Now you want me to give you $100 to go buy a 10 speed. And he said, I'm not going to do it. He said, well, come here, follow me. And so he walks into the garage and he opens the door and he points to the shovel. He points to the rake and he points to the lawnmower. He said, if you want a bike, you buy it. And I was like, but dude, I'm 9, I'm about to turn 10. He said, but I don't want the bike. You do. And let me tell you this. If a man wants to eat, a man has to work. He said, I'll loan you the gas for the first tank for the lawnmower. And so he said, and you figure it out. And he walked away. So he loaned me to get money to buy the first tank of gas. And this was probably, my birthday's in July. It's July 15th. So this was probably around the early parts of May or so.
Yeah.
By the time my birthday passed into maybe early August, I had the money to buy a bike. I bought my own bike. It got stolen a month later.
He taught you financial literacy, which is a universal life skill. I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about, you know.
He also told me a little bit like about delayed gratification too, which is that sometimes what you think you want it because everybody else is wanting it, and maybe you should think a little bit ahead. Hey, vision a little bit ahead. And so that was a valuable lesson that I learned as a 9, 10 year old.
And that's great that you learned that at such a young age, because there are so many people that never learn that at home. And it's the parents that are charged with passing on these essential universal life skills to their children, where most parents, I would venture to say, are not equipped in and of themselves. They don't have the proficiency to effectively teach their children, and they rely on school. And as we all know, schools are not doing that either, right? So I've interviewed a lot of young people, and I ask them, and I'm going to ask you too, where did you learn your life skills?
I learned my life skills from my village. So
yeah,
when I grew up in a place like Gary, and I think Gary is unique in this regard, because first of all, the people who were my teachers were also, well, most of the case, looked like me, which I don't think that's a necessity.
Right.
But they were people who wanted something better, and they expected that my generation would make manifest the things that they couldn't make. So if you, for example, if you were growing up in the 40s, in the 50s, and you're in an America that hasn't yet resolved any issues with race. We're still talking about Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 and school busing and those kind of things.
Right.
What they were hoping for me was that I would have an opportunity to do whatever I wanted to do. You know, many people I had had you know, advanced degrees, and they were relegated to having to teach. And now they found value in teaching, but they were people who today would not be in the classroom.
Right.
Like, you're not going to a classroom if you've got an MBA. You're not going to a classroom if you're a master's in something. You're probably going to be working for some corporation. Those opportunities were not available to them. So they were pouring in everything that they had into me. And the expectations that they have for their own children, they have for me. I'm here having this conversation with you today. I tell people, because I have what I call a starting five. There were five people outside of my home who told me at the end of my sophomore year in high school that essentially I wasn't living up to my potential. And they expected more of me. And not only did they expect more of me, they were going to show me essentially how to be me. So I got those, you know.
Oh, mentorship is so, and frankly, most of my mentors throughout my life have looked like you too, you know, and I was very blessed for that because it gave me, like I said, I grew up all over the world, you know, my dad was a diplomat and a cultural diplomat, and we were in countries like Brazil and Cuba that had a long history of people who came from enslavement and who were brought there against their will. And the wisdom that I feel, I'll say it, I feel very privileged to have inherited out of a loving gesture, not out of anybody telling them, okay, now it's your job that you got to teach this white kid, you know. It was really a gesture of love. And it's made me the man I am now. And I gleaned. And I think that people like you and me, children of the 60s, we were born at a time when the civil rights movement in America had just barely taken hold, and yet it was the foundation of everything we know. And what a gift to be born in 1966, right? Because we've seen the transformation, not just of America, but America's impact on the world. The agency that my dad worked for called the USIA, which no longer exists because mission accomplished. They were the propaganda wing of the US government. So they basically took all this appropriated culture, right, that was brought here by the settlers and, you know, others, and wrapped it up in a big red, white, and blue ribbon and sold it back to the world as American, with the message, we did it better than you did it. And so now we own it and we're going to sell it back to you. And they did. It was a brilliant PR campaign. And this was at a time before there was a McDonald's outside the US. There was a time. And I remember these huge expos in giant airplane hangars of everything from fast food to entertainment, music, Broadway, air and space industry, all of the different industries were represented as being American as apple pie and baseball. Well, guess what? Apple pie and baseball are not American. I'm here to tell you. So we had that gift of being born at a time where everything was possible. Mm-hmm.
Your generous sponsorship and individual support of the Lost Traveler podcast benefits the Lost Travelers Club, a charitable project under the fiscal sponsorship of United Charitable, a nonprofit 501c3 organization. The Lost Travelers Club focuses primarily on the needs of parents who have outlived their beloved children. We recently launched our new Brain Candy Project Wing, providing art supplies to children still struggling with critical or terminal health-related conditions. We hope to raise enough funds to launch Brain Candy, an arts and literature magazine created by and for these young people. Find out more at www.braincandy.online. Thank you.
As a father of a young man who's now heading into his, in some circles it's called his Saturn return, right? This is the time where the things in the heavenly bodies are coming back into alignment at the same time as his birth. And so it's a wrapping up of a cycle. It's the beginning of a new cycle. It's a purging of all that doesn't work for you anymore. You sort of graduate to a new level of adulthood at 28, where you start figuring that out. Who am I going to be for the rest of my life? Who's going to stick around in my life, right? And that's about 7 year cycle. And things happen 7 year cycles, right? You start first grade at 7, you start high school at 14, you're an adult at 21, right? It's all 7 year cycles. And then 28 begins a new cycle until about 33, which is your Jesus year, right? That's when you're exactly, it's all in sevens. So being the father of a 28-year-old who is now going into his new cycle of adulthood, is everything still possible in his world? And where did he learn his life skills?
Is everything still possible? Yes.
Does he know it?
Yeah, he absolutely knows it. He's been hearing me preach that. So the life skill, he's been hearing me preach that to him forever. So
yes.
You mentioned names. So uniquely, like you, we decided to wait. So in terms of sevens, we decided to wait until the eighth day. So 7 days passed before we gave him a name. And his name is Naeem Kahari Turner Bandelli. And you mentioned culture and languages. So
yes.
Naeem is Arabic. It means benevolent. Kahari is Swahili. It means kingly. Turner, which we talked about, Nat Turner, is a slave, has its origin as a slave name. And Bandelli is Yoruba. And it means born away from home. So his full name is, he is a benevolent king, despite being born from slavery and away from home.
Beautiful.
And so the entirety of his life, he's been reminded that his responsibility is to do that, to be benevolent, to be kingly, and to understand that there are people who made sacrifices for him all around the world, et cetera. And so that's his responsibility, to find a way to make the planet better. And that's what he's been working to do from the very beginning. And it's what he continues to do. In fact, his work that he just did it with his dissertation is around energy and power systems. And his objective is to find a way to make energy less expensive and available for people anywhere in the world. He lived in Brazil, so there's a Brazil connection.
Okay.
He moved to Brazil as a 16-year-old.
Wow.
And played soccer in one of Brazil's top soccer academies. And he stayed there until I was a little over a year. He had a concussion. He ended up turning home. But while he was there, he said, I figured out exactly what I want to do if I don't want my soccer career. So he said, I want to be an engineer. And I want to use technology to enhance the lives of people who have been historically and geographically underserved.
I've got a project for him.
Okay. And he's fluent in Spanish and Portuguese. Okay. And yeah. So.
Well, and actually, this has to do with Africa.
Okay.
Too. This is another sort of full circle moment in our conversation, because about a year ago, I got a call from a friend of mine in Massachusetts who is an early childhood education specialist. And he said, Henry, I just got a call or a message on Facebook from a young man in Uganda, and he's 28 years old. Go figure. And he has single-handedly rescued and adopted 33 children from the slums of the capital city, ages 2 to 14, these kids. And he's raising them. And all he can afford are two tiny rooms in the slums. He's got 33 kids crammed into two tiny rooms. They don't have food. They don't have water. And he contacted me, not for a handout, not for help with that, but he, you know, the kids, I think there are, I want to say like eight of them that are not yet school age.
Okay.
The youngest is two, right? So, and he didn't have any expertise in early childhood education. So he was casting a wide net from his mobile phone, which is all he had, globally looking for specialists to mentor him. And my friend said, Henry, I know you have a background in education. It just hit me like a ton of bricks that you are meant to be his mentor. I know it in my bones. Would you contact him? His name is Bugingo.
Okay.
His mother nicknamed him Desire because she wants the world to desire what he's putting out there.
Okay.
Benevolence and kindness and kindliness mm-hmm. and all those things you mentioned, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Bugingo and I said, how are you managing? He said, well, we just got an eviction notice. We're about to be put out on the streets again, and I don't know what to do. And I said, have you incorporated as a company, as an organization to help these kids so you can raise money to help them? He said, no, I can't afford it. It costs like $800 US to become a nonprofit there. And it was just completely out of reach. And I said, well, what about just incorporating as like a limited company to start, you know? And he said, well, let me check around and see if I know anybody who can help get that, because I know that that's more in our league, you know, of ability.
Right. So
within 2 days, he had it done. He had a business bank account. He had a PO box. He had it all set. I said, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build you a website and I'm going to be your middleman, right? There's no PayPal in Uganda. And I said, people can, if you trust me, people will send me the funds and I will forward them to you. I'll do a money transfer to your bank. And we started fundraising last August. We've since gotten all the kids out of the slums. 22 of the kids are in the countryside with his mother in the fresh air and sunshine. They still have to walk 2 miles each way to get fresh drinking water. I mean, there are so many things that they have to endure in the poverty that they're in that even the lowest economic strata of Americans could never even imagine. They lost a boy to a lion attack on his way back from getting water. He ran ahead of the other kids and he never made it home. And they got there and they were like, where's Goloba? And nobody knew. And he was 11 years old and had a tendency to run ahead because he wanted to get there before everybody else. And they found out later that a pride of 8 lions had been seen in the area. And they found his remains. And it was just, I mean, to live daily with that kind of stress is crazy. And it puts things into perspective. You know, we've managed to do a lot for these kids. It's still an uphill battle, still a struggle, but it's been nothing but miraculous to watch people rise up to this.
Well, I'm sure you're going to share with me afterwards how I can help in some way or support what he's doing.
You know, you and everybody else, everyone else, and people think, oh, I don't have anything to send. I'm struggling myself. You know, I have people who send $5 now and again. I have people who send $10 a month, right? What is that? 2 lattes from Starbucks? I mean, come on, people.
Right. Maybe one.
We're talking fresh water here for children and education fees and, you know, bedding. They were sleeping on a foam pad on the, you know, on the ground. I mean, it's crazy. And I know there are a lot more kids out there that need help in many countries, war-torn countries, extreme poverty in India and Africa. And, you know, a lot of Americans don't even realize that Africa is not a country.
Yes, no, they
there are like 50 plus countries, 52, yeah. 52 countries in Africa, and everyone is having its struggles. And so I know that we can't help all the kids yet until we really shift the paradigm. And I want to get into that with you in the last bit of this, because I believe it's possible to shift the paradigm. I believe 100% that it's possible, but we have to have conversations like this. We have to provide what you call propulsion forward and elevation in our humanity. We can't help all the kids of the world right now in this moment, but I know 33 we can help. And a whole lot of people doing just a little bit adds up faster than you would think. That $5, that $10, that $20, that $100 goes a long, long way. And I have actually in the body of the podcast, I have a little promo that describes them and how people can help with their website and everything else. It'll be right after this segment.
Okay, cool.
Hey, are you like me, always looking for ways to make a positive impact in the world? Well, then join me in sponsoring Desire Child Care Organization. We are a legally incorporated, fully volunteer-based organization in Uganda, committed to providing essential needs, holistic arts-based education, and a safe family environment to 33 vulnerable children, ages 2 to 14. Your monthly sponsorship can help improve the lives of these kids toward a better future. Desire Childcare is different from any other charity I know because, well, we have zero administrative overhead. Every penny goes to the kids. And we have a plan toward self-sufficiency through agriculture. So support is temporary. It's kind of like a leg up. Visit desirechildcare.org to learn more and get involved. Let's empower and inspire the Desire Kids together. Thanks.
So tell me about human propulsion, humanity propulsion, engineering.
So as I mentioned, my son's the engineer. And when I first mentioned this to him, he said, you know, that you're not an engineer. I said, yes, no, I know. I know I'm not trained as an engineer. But I do believe in social engineering, which is what humanity propulsion engineering. And so honestly, when I first said it was really as a way to just get people's attention. Because what typically happens when someone is an author or someone speaks, then people basically label everyone as an author and some former public speaker or motivational speaker. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't necessarily believe motivation is external. I don't think external motivation works at all. I think motivation is best when it's intrinsic. That being said, I'm like, I need to find a way to convey to people who it is that I am or that I'd like to be when my time is up. And so the humanity propulsion engineer came to me like, this seems to make sense. So it's pretty simple, right? You understand humanity, we're talking about people, we're talking about care and compassion. Propulsion meaning up or forward, and I always add positively. And then engineering is just tools, techniques, and strategies to help us to do those things. So what does that mean? It means my objective in my life is to be a person who helps, serves, and makes sure other people know that their lives matter. I consider that humanity, and I consider that part of propelling the fabric of a planet forward.
That's beautiful. That's powerful. We need more of that in the world. I haven't heard of anybody else talking about it like that.
Someone said, I have a friend and she's a practicing attorney. I don't practice. And she said, better get that trademark. I said, yes, I know. I better get a trademark. But yes, that's the objective.
Are you working alone in that or are you collaborating with others? Do you have a nonprofit or do you have any other plans for those things?
So you talked about my evolution earlier. My evolution really has been Naeem's father. So for so long, my identity, as you mentioned, my identity was that of his dad. In fact, so much so that when he left here as a 16-year-old, I started a blog called Raising Superman. I wrote letters to him as a child from age 2 to 16, and he got ready to go to Brazil. Took some of the letters and I put them in a binder and I gave them to him. You're gonna be about 7,000 miles away from me. You're not gonna want to hear what I have to say because you're grown. And so when he was in Brazil, after spending, I think, the first 4 or 5 days there, I went to Rio. He was in a small town called Porto Feliz. My wife said, "You're going to have to go back. I don't think he's doing well. I'll go back to see if he's going to want to come back to the States." He says, "No, Dad, I got a question for you." I said, "I got a question for you. I just spent $415 for a cab ride here.
That's
Are we leaving or are we staying?" He says, "No, we're staying. I'm staying. But let me ask you a question. You gave me the binder with these letters. I reread the first three. Did you put them in a particular order?" I said, "No." So he said, "Why?" Because I remember my purpose. I'm going to be fine. "But Dad, whenever I do return, we're going to take these letters and we're going to publish them. We're going to share them with other people. Because when you tell me I can do something, not only do I know I can do it, I know it's supposed to happen." And it's because of his insistence on sharing these letters that his father had written him throughout his childhood, because his father did not expect to live this long. I expected that I would be gone, that I
Really?
would not see him. Yes. I also expected that I would be a terrible father. And like my father, I figured I would ruin our relationship. And I wanted to make sure that at some point before I effed it up or I died, that he knew that I wasn't always a jerk. And that I authentically loved him, and the graces that I've been here with him. But at the time he got those letters, he said, "We should publish them." So that was his idea. And people only know me today and the work that I've done outside of what was my profession for nearly 30 years. It's because of my relationship with him, and him decided that I'd said something worthwhile to him that should be shared with others.
And that's the book Raising Superman. I will put a link to that and your other books as well in the description of the podcast, because I think that this is an inspiration to fathers everywhere. And boy, that could be a whole other episode talking about manhood and fatherhood in the 21st century, being raised in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know.
So then that because of that, when some of the media first heard of it, we promoted it a little bit. I did what he told me to do. He said, "Do these things." I said, "Okay, so whatever you say, do." But then when people would start asking, "So like, why would you write him and what's the big deal about it?" And then it opened up this whole avenue to talk about other things. I get to say, "Well, kind of here's the big deal. He got admitted to 27 America's top engineering schools. And he had more scholarship money on his own than most high schools graduating classes get." And they're like, "Well, really? How did you do that?" "Well, before he was born, I wrote Harvard and asked for an application. And I didn't know if we were having a male or female. And so we decided to backward design a child's life so that that child could meet the academic qualifications of a school like Harvard." And then people say, well, did it work? Did he go to Harvard?" "No, he chose not to go to Harvard. But here's the schools, all the litany of schools that said yes to him. And oh, by the way, now he's finishing his undergrad degree. He's finishing in electrical engineering, and he has a minor in computer science, computer engineering, and he's got 7 PhD fellowship offers directly from undergrad. And one of them is to Carnegie Mellon, and it's a full ride." And so then that sort of changed the conversation. People were like, "Well, how did you figure out? How did you figure
Yeah, that was going to be
out?"
my next question. What inspired you to even think to, before he was born, to reach out that way?
My child, my relationship with my dad was not a good relationship. And as I mentioned, I didn't want to be a father at all. So you mentioned Lion, and here's the thing, right? I went to the movie with this woman I was dating, watched the movie Lion King. And well, we were married. And so she says, she's talking about her biological clock is ticking. And I'm like, "Yo, your biological clock is digital. You can't hear it." So I'm not trying to mess up anybody's life. She says, no, like, I want to be a parent." And I'm like, "Okay." And then I see this story with these two lions and this baby lion named Simba and this father lion, Mufasa. And Simba goes and does something he's not supposed to do, goes out right to the elephant graveyard. And Mufasa goes and saves him, and he comes back and lectures him. Then after a while, the mood changes, and Simba says, "But Dad, we're pals, right?" And then in that moment, I'm like, there's hope for me. Like these animated characters have shown me that I can have a relationship with a child that is like that. And so I'm like, "Okay, but you're gonna need a plan. You can't just look at a movie and say that this is going to potentially happen. You're going to need a plan. And so I was a law student. I was not a great law student. There was no one knocking on my door asking me to come work for their firm. But I said, well, you know what? Maybe if I go into a different law school, this would be different. Even if I was at Harvard and my grades were average, you know what people would be doing? They'd be knocking on my door because I was at Harvard.
That's
You know
right.
what people would do when I walked in the room? They'd say, hey, that's a Harvard graduate, Nate Turner. They would say that first. So I said, okay, well, what if I could have gone to Harvard? Well, then what would you need to do an undergrad to go to Harvard? Well, you'd need to go to a different undergrad. Well, how would you go to a better undergrad? Well, you'd need to done better in high school. How would you done better in high school? And so you get it. So I said, well, at the very beginning, my parents would have needed to have planned for this, and they didn't. But now I know, so why not plan for it? So I get the application from Harvard. Of course, it tells me the academic component, but then there are two other, to me, the better parts of the application. Said one, they wanted students that were world citizens. So you mentioned being married, you're being parented by a cultural diplomat. So in many ways, that's exactly what I was thinking about. Like, how do I do that? And then the third thing was, they said they wanted people who care for something greater than themselves. I'm like,
Right.
okay. So this is the backdrop for what we're going to do whenever this child is born. We're going to make sure this child is intellectually ambitious. We're going to make sure this child is globally and culturally competent. We're going to raise someone who's humanitarian driven.
And
And
that's reverse engineering, which is so vital. We have to know our history. How do we know who we are if we don't know where we come from? And there are people, especially of our generation, who have been told ad infinitum, that you're going to repeat all the stuff that your parents did, right? You're doomed in a sense to repeat what they, but you know what? There are people like you, Nate, and people like me that said, I don't accept that. I'm going to be the parent I needed. I'm going to be the mentor I needed. I'm going to be the teacher I needed. And that for you, that for me has been the thrust of my parenting. It's been the thrust of my work as an educator, as an artist. It's touched every aspect of my life. And I can only bless the fact that my parents did not have a full toolkit to raise me. I can be sit here today in the autumn of our years and say, I am grateful for all of the challenges that I faced in my foundation, because they provided me with the impulse, with the propulsion, if you will, to do better and to be better and to take that little toxic vial of poison that's passed on a little down-filled royal purple gold tassel pillow from one generation to say, I accepted this dysfunction from my parents, and now I pass the toxicity on to you. And I took that thing and I smashed it on the ground, said it was never mine, and it was never intended for me. That's not what my ancestors wanted for me. And
Agreed.
so I destroyed it.
Yeah.
And because of that, I was the I was the outsider in my family. A guy wire is a tensioned cable that is designed to enhance the stability of a freestanding structure. Think of me as your guy wire in terms of life skills mentoring. You're perfectly capable of standing stably on your own two feet, but I'm a cable that can enhance your stability. I'm available for individual or couples counseling, life skills mentorship, child loss grief support, LGBTQ plus support. I can also officiate weddings, end of life ceremonies, baby namings, invocations, or whatever guidance you may need. I serve all genders, all ages. Sessions are affordable, discreet, private, and conducted online. Find me at guy-wire.org. Book your appointment today. And now I get to walk this earth fearlessly. And with every challenge comes an opportunity. You and I know this because we got through it. We got through the challenge of parents not having the, it's not that they were, you know, badly intended, right? They loved us in their way, which makes it forgivable to me. Anything that's done out of a love, even if it's a messed up, twisted kind of love, if the impulse is love, it's forgivable. And it allowed me to have a relationship with my parents that grew over time, more healthy. I lost my dad to COVID a couple of years ago. He was 84. And the last thing I said to him was, "Dad, tell me a joke." And he smiled and he giggled and fell asleep. That was my last moment over a video chat with my dad. How cool is that?
Yeah, that is. My happy ending with my dad was not such a happy ending, but yeah, that's.
It's never too late, even if they've crossed over.
The cool thing is, and I say this to folks, my father and I could never figure out, and I'll say we, because it, two people in a relationship, no point in me blaming him for anything.
That's right.
We can never figure it out. But I tell people all the time, my father's still alive now. My father lives based upon, that was the promise that I made when my father passed. I think I wrote it in our blog that my objective at this point was to just to live my life in a way that kept my father's name alive. And that when people saw me, as they would say in the old days, that Nate, he's the son of so-and-so, that they would remember him because I was going to do good in the world. So, yeah. And I've learned in his lessons that he gave me as a child, sometimes when you're a child, you can't fully understand and appreciate the lessons until you get older. And I find myself now regurgitating many of the things that my father said.
Isn't that the scariest thing ever, is to hear your father's voice come out of your mouth?
Absolutely. I hear it all the time. It's
frightening at first, but then you get used to it and it's like, oh, okay, well, you can embrace it and to a degree, but hopefully it's better words and a more proficient toolkit, that's for sure.
Yeah, and probably a little more grace and mercy said when I say it. My dad was famous for saying to me that if he gave me something that worked for me, use it, and if it didn't, throw it away. Mm. And I used to think that was like, man, that is the most cowardly advice. Why don't you just do better? Stop telling me this nonsense. And as I think about it now, no, it makes perfect sense. It's like having a toolkit. You and I can get in the car and think we're going to travel somewhere and someone say, hey, Henry Cameron and Nate, y'all got a toolkit? And we're like, oh, no, we're fine. We're fine. And my dad's lesson would be, just take it. If you need it, you have it.
That's
right.
If
you don't, fine. But you better serve to have it than to need it and not have it. And so that's what I understood. I understand now at the time, whatever.
My dad's favorite expression was, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And it always drove me up a wall because he said it all the time. But now I get it.
Right.
Now exactly. I get it, you know? And that's the thing. That's the beauty of reverse engineering. Whether you're an actual parent, or whether you're like me, a former parent, or if you're in the parenting generation, you don't have children. To reverse engineer your own story and to study your biography is the best toolkit you can ever develop. You can't use my tools. You and I are sitting here for an hour laying our tools out on the table, free for people to use, right? But they can't use them the way that we use them. They're not us. They don't have our biography. But what they have is the toolkit that they already possess. And they can take some of these tools and play with them and synthesize them with the tools that they've already got and say, hey, I created a new tool.
Right.
Right. And they can choose to share it or not in their way.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. I'm Queen Bee Divine. The cure is conversation. And where can you find me? At BluntReflections.com, where I will be talking to guests from around the world that not only share their time, but their insights and their tips on how they became the best version of who they were meant to be. So if you're looking for a great story and a great time, check me out at BluntReflections.com. The cure is conversation. And remember, blasé, blasé means to tell your story.
I can't believe it's been an hour, Nate. I mean, this is crazy. We got to do a part two. Please promise me we'll come back.
Anytime. I'm happy to do it. Absolutely. If you don't call me, I'm going to be disappointed.
Okay, no, we'll definitely, you're stuck with me. We're going to stay in touch, and I want to support your work as well in any way I can, because I believe in you. I believe in what you're doing and who you are and what you're doing for the world and for children and for parents. It's a big, big passion of mine, too. So
you mentioned it. Go ahead. I was going to say, you asked me about any not-for-profit stuff. So we did start a not-for-profit real quick. We called the League of Extraordinary Parents, and the goal was to help parents be able to help their own children. If it is true that there's trees and fruits and that only good trees can raise good fruit and so forth, then the objective was to help parents and give parents some tools and some strategies, techniques. We are all of us who are parents biologically or by surrogate, because I have a whole bunch of children now that are not my children, that are somebody else's children who in many cases didn't do the best job that they could do, who I feel now responsible to and obligated for. But the goal was just to show parents, because in this, and I don't know about other places, you know better than I do, because I've not traveled extensively. But in this country, we do such a horrible job. We have Lamas that teach people how to breathe and eat ice chips and how to deliver a baby. But we have no strategies for how to create citizens for a nation that allows the nation to be productive and move forward in a positive fashion. So that's what we are essentially trying to do.
Is this nonprofit still functioning? Is it still?
Yes, it is. It's the League of my wife, my son, and I, and one of my closest friends from my childhood, Dr. Underwood, we've been working on that. And I was in Buffalo a couple of weeks ago, sort of doing that similar kind of work in the city of Buffalo.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I'll put a link to that in the description as well.
Okay.
For anyone who wants to find out more and to gain some tools as a parent or as someone in the parenting generation or someone who works with children or runs into them in the park. So the time has come at the end of the episode. And thank you again for co-hosting with me. This has been eye-opening and heart-growing. What's your question for the next?
This one is easy. I was like, I could have answered that earlier. So my question is, who? My question is, who are you? And who will you be when your time on this planet is up? Who will your obituary say you are? Who will people say you are when they speak about you in your eulogy? And who will you appear as on your last words and testament on your tomb or your urn or whatever? Who?
Beautiful. I will be excited to hear the answer to that question.
It's a lot. I'll be tuning in to hear it.
All right, brother. We'll stay in touch. Thank you, listeners, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Season 4 of the Lost Traveler Podcast with Henry Cameron Allen. Visit me online at henryallen.org. Thank you to my guests, and thank you for tuning in. Let's keep striving for a better world together.